publishing it in the name of Resistance Books and Merlin Press and the International Institute for Research and Education in Amsterdam. And the reason we decided to, or Catherine approached me and other comrades to think about publishing the book is, first of all, because this year is the 80th anniversary of the split between Tito and Stalin. And the former Yugoslavia is an important part of the book, and I'll come back on that. But also because I think it fits into current debates that are going on now in terms of strategies for revolution, strategies for popular power, strategies for democracy and the commons. And when she proposed the title of the book, Decolonial Communism, Democracy and the Commons, being an activist, I was a bit taken aback by us using the term decolonial communism because, you know, when you're an active in your trade union branch, your Labour Party branch, you know, doing stalls on the street, etc., these are not terms that you would normally use. You know, you see on the TV news of students who are doing a very good thing in terms of tearing down the symbols of colonialism in universities, etc., etc., renaming houses, which I call Cecil Rhodes House, to something else, right? But the important thing behind the term of decolonial communism is about decolonial communism is about power relations, not just power relations between colonial states and subaltern countries and so on. It's about power relationships within states, within society, and within political parties as well, right? Between and relations within the left and within the parties themselves. And that's reclaiming that democracy is important. That's part of the history of which is in the book about the struggle after the fall of the dictatorship in Portugal in the early 70s for workers' control, and in Chile under Allende for types of workers' control as well. So there's discussions and about those experiences, which some of us will remember because we were alive then. Very important part of the book is the question of Yugoslavia, because even though it's a bit of our history, which I think is a bit forgotten. We talk about 1917, the Russian Revolution, Cuba, Vietnam, China, etc., etc. But Yugoslavia is a bit forgotten. Partly, I think, precisely because of the Tito-Stalin split, right? The Orthodox communist movement denounced it as being, Tito is Trotskyist, or whatever it was. They're basically Trotskyist or whatever, right? And the important thing about Yugoslavia is that on their own, in the course of the war, the Second World War, not only did they liberate the country without the help of British imperialism, but also despite the diktats from Moscow that Yugoslavia should go into the Western camp, just like Greece was supposed to go and is in the Western camp, and Churchill sent troops into and the British government and the British Labour government did as well to suppress the independence and communist movement in Greece. And it's in the course of the war, I think, that the Yugoslav communists gained their maturity and their thoughts about working with different nationalities, instituting organs of popular power when it was possible in the occupied territories there themselves, refusing to have, maintaining some relations with British imperialism, discussing what sort of strategic, whenever it was necessary, how they should confront those who supported the Italians without occupying the country, etc., etc., right? And the royalists, confronting those alliances which British imperialism and the Soviet Union wanted them to have with, right? And they maintained their independence in that context and pursued, following the war and their victory in the war, which they did independently, suppressing basically capitalist mode of production. And there's a brief period, not immediately after the war, and Catherine will discuss that, the period of self-management. Albeit it was imposed, but brought from the top for reasons which Catherine and Gilbert will go into. But nevertheless, that period of self-management is extremely important for us to understand how there's other models than simply the Soviets of 1917, right? Petrograd. It's important, and we've got great lessons from that. But there's in countries in capitalist countries, although Yugoslavia was really part of the periphery, there's other ways of there's different strategic roles that we must look at in terms of democracy, the communes, popular power, and so on. Right. So finally, just to conclude, the book is going to be out very shortly, maybe before Christmas or shortly afterwards. The details of how to get it is here. And I think, you know, it's important because we need to reclaim our past, especially those bits of our past which are forgotten and suppressed, in order to understand how we move forward for the future.
Okay, I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to present that book and be involved in some important discussions. But first, I want to inform you that the Darko Suvin, who was to be with us, cannot be. Hello, I want to present him briefly. Darko Suvin is now 90 years old. He presents himself always like a Yugoslav, a Marxist, an epistemologist, a political epistemologist. And he was involved in Croatia. He's from a Jewish family, and he was confronted. He lost many of his many members of his family. He was confronted to the Ustashi fascist regime in Croatia, and to the Nazi invasion and dismantling of Yugoslavia. And he was engaged as a young boy in the communist youth. And so he stayed in Yugoslavia during the first two best decades of that experience, that is up to 68, when then he went to Canada. And so because of his age, it was difficult to come here because of different reasons of health, but the main problem is his wife, who has an Alzheimer and completely dependent on him. And so we decided to organize a Skype here. And that was being organized up to yesterday. And yesterday evening he called me that because of health conditions for his wife, he has to go with her to a medical appointment. So he cannot even be involved in the Skype. So I will take some time to both present the book, and that is our book, and present in the same moment the way it is in conversation and in deep, how do you say, with a deep agreement with Darko Suvin's own book, which I'm in the process of writing a review for New Left Review, Splendor, Misery, and Possibilities, an X-ray of Socialist Yugoslavia, which I would like to really stress as an impressive contribution, both as a witness and also as a Marxist thinker, a Marxist from the warm current, as he says, that is Bloch, Gramsci, and this kind of currents, living Marxism. So I will integrate a presentation of his own point of view, very close to precisely what I defended also in the book here. As Fred said, the book, The Colonial Communism, Democracy and Commons, is produced in a period that is today of anniversaries. He said the anniversary of the split between Stalin and Tito, that is with the Yugoslav Revolution occurring within the Second World War and breaking with Stalin and its allies in 1943 within the World War already, and with the split with Stalin in 1948. But it is also in the framework of the anniversary of October Revolution last year, and in the framework of the anniversary of 1968, which was also a turning, it, an international turning point also in Yugoslavia. And those three so-called events, that is historical periods in fact, that is the October Revolution, Yugoslav Revolution and split with Stalin, and 68, revisited in 2008, are historical periods within an international crisis of an imperialist world capitalist system. In all those periods, that is the First World War, the Second World War, 68, the years 60s in general. And today, again, looking backward, we are confronted to, of course, a completely different imperialist world system. And one of the issues is to update the analysis of how did it transform itself after precisely the counter-revolution, as David Herweg describes its turn, so-called neoliberalist, neoliberal turn in the 70s, 80s, and Margaret Thatcher, Tina, and afterwards 89 and transformation of the countries which proclaim to be socialist and so on. And what is today imperialist? What is the North, the South, how it is transformed, and what kind of resistance to it? So this this raises also the question not only of what kind of system in crisis, but also what kind of alternative. So the book, first I want to make a complementary comment to what Fred said about the concept of decolonial communism, and then present the two axes of the book, first the concept of decolonial communism, here as it is used, it's extended outside, I would say, the dominant fields of current studies on decolonial issues, but it expressed the same criteria. That is, the idea that the decolonial currents put forward, the need, which is fundamental for a communist orientation, to analyze and fight against any lasting form or trace of colonial, and we used to use the term neocolonialism, but anyway, any trace of neocolonialism within former or present dependent or dominant countries and in their international relations. But in the concrete context of the book, this has been introduced linked to the October Revolution to stress something that I want to underline, is I call here decolonial communism the let's say complex political and theoretical resistance to all relation, including the idea that socialist communist currents in semi-peripheral countries, that is neocolonized countries of the capitalist world system, should wait for, or had to, or should now wait for any kind of socioeconomic preconditions to break with capitalism, or should wait for models of development presented or coming from developed countries, and so to be submitted to the development of the revolution first in developed countries, and later on when the productive force would be developed enough. Okay, so you see that was a dividing point between Bolsheviks and Mensheviks at the time of October Revolution. That was a dividing point for the building of the Comintern, that is the Third International, within October Revolution itself, in the context of that, as a rupture with social democratic currents of the Second International, which would wait for a development within capitalism and most developed capitalist country for a socialist revolution. That is to say that the October Revolution, but we can also say Yugoslav, Vietnamese, Cuban Revolution in third world countries, so-called, or semi-peripheral countries, were premature from that point of view. And so I relate strongly the notion of decolonial thinking, which is deeply, which was, even with that word, was not used at that time, but it is deeply within even Marx himself, evolution in the thinking of the world capitalist system and the way he looked at the Irish and black revolts and so on, and the resistance to the British imperialists in his margins and so on. So Marx himself changed it at a certain moment, and even in a Manifesto Communiste, the Communist Manifesto, there was a kind of Eurocentric Western bias, and he himself, he changed that. And afterwards, with the analysis by Lenin and Rosa Luxemburg and so on of imperialism, and with Trotsky's approach and systematization of permanent revolution, that is combined and even in combined development of social formations in the peripheral countries under the domination of imperialist financing and conditions and so on, the concept of revolution was completely different. So in the during the First World War, Lenin April thesis and Trotsky's positions and so on, the idea of the socialist revolution was conceived as a process of break with a capitalist with capitalism as a system, as a world system with relationship of domination, and the process of a socialist transformation behind the notion of permanent revolution was a complex process, not a linear one, but which was beginning and encouraged in a national break, but the taking of power was only the very beginning of a transformation without any recipe on how to build a new society, but with the idea that anyway the conditions to change the society were also linked to the possibility of an extension of the revolution in the world. And of course, with the Stalinization of Soviet Union, that was broken at a certain level. Then I'm coming to, to finish with this aspect, what I wanted to say is the idea of decolonial communism is deeply rooted in that notion of permanent revolution, you see, and is deeply rooted also within the way, even within the Tsarist Empire and an international relationship of the October Revolution, Lenin himself put forward a very radical anti-colonialist standpoint, position, and within the Comintern, that question of anti-colonialism in the eighth condition of the 21 condition to enter the Comintern was the question of fighting against racism and fighting against any kind of colonial relationship of domination, both in the core countries and in dominated countries and so on. So that is to put a link between the ongoing debates on decolonial studies today and the real beginning of a process of decolonial thinking and practice with the October Revolution, which was afterwards also, of course, in Yugoslavia and China and Vietnam and Cuba put forward. Then the two axes within the book. There are two axes within the book, which for a Marxist point of view, of course, are deeply dialectically related. That is, an axis of about the permanent revolution in the sense of development of struggles, resistance, new revolutions. And the second axis, which is how to transform the society after the taking of power. That is, the debates, the first debates which occurred in October, after October Revolution in Soviet Union, the first Marxist debate in the making, that is, in the context of a changing of power, that is, what kind of society, what use of money, what use of market, what kind of planning, what kind of democracy, what kind of transformation of social relationship with right and wrong ideas, no model, no scientific knowledge. And so a dialectical evolution of the debate up to today. So, and then in the both axes, the Yugoslav experience is interesting. So the first issue about struggles, of course, the main idea of the book in the context of anniversary or so of October Revolution is that the Stalinization of Soviet Union was an element of counter-revolution within the revolution with open futures, but it could not stop revolutions, but it tried to control them. So not a pure situation of the Second World War. And the fundamental and empirical, also historical fact is that within the class conflicts and international class conflicts were strong enough in Yugoslavia and China and afterwards also in decolonial world and to go forward and to continue the process of permanent revolution even against the Stalinization. So that's the first point. Which is but then the Yugoslav, as Fred said in the presentation, the Yugoslav communists were confronted to a very radical polarization of forces. I don't go here into the detail, we'll see in the discussion, but anyway, but it was confronted to Yalta kind of agreements, where Yugoslavia was supposed, as he said, to stay in the western side. So in 1943, during the war, there was a real process, a political conscience process of founding a new Yugoslav project on the base of the committees, the councils, anti-fascist and people councils, which existed in all villages, towns in the whole country, and distributing lands and permitting a process which is not a process controlled only by the hierarchy of the Communist Party, but which is a dialectical process of real development, of mass mobilization, with both a social deep contained with the mobilization of that was of peasants, that was a society of 73% of peasants at the time. So the armed struggle and the popular army, Yugoslav popular army, was massively based on peasants, and this, there were something like 17% of workers at that time, on workers and intellectuals, radical intellectuals, organized in the popular army in councils and in a general assembly of that, which proclaimed in 43. No to the coming back of the king, no to the old order. So that was both a process of independent rooting the mobilization in the mass mobilization and national mobilization in Yugoslavia, giving the conditions of a break both with capitalist and imperialist domination, and also the precondition of independent road
from a Stalin kind of a diktat and building socialism in one country. So this is the first axe of the book, the question of struggles, which fits with what Darko Suving is presenting, that is the reality of partisan struggles and of revolutionary process as a real precondition of the second, what he calls the second singularities of the Yugoslav system, which was the break with Stalin. And this comes, and this is to stress that in 1948, within that struggle, Stalin wanted, if he couldn't prevent the revolution, he wanted at least to control it. And he imposed even the political conditions and socio-economical conditions, even for the aid which was supposed to be given to the new Yugoslav regime. And precisely because the new regime came to power through a mass revolutionary mobilization, he could resist to this and say no, even if he wanted that aid. But he said no to the conditionality of that aid. So, and how did he say no? How did he resist to Stalin? He resisted to Stalin with an anti-statist position, using Marx's praising of Paris Commune and Lenin State and Revolution against Stalin, which is a little bit different from what would be the Maoist and Soviet conflict later on, where Mao would praise Stalin against Khrushchev, which is a little bit different. So the dynamic was a second kind of revolutionary process within the revolution, which is an open criticism of bureaucracy, an open criticism of the bureaucratization of a communist party after a revolution if it doesn't change the social relationship. And so the emphasis, the official introduction of self-management, that is workers' council, first in industry and then generalized in the whole society except the army, in 1950, was the complement to the break with Stalin. That is to find first the possibility to have a real legitimation and also stimulant to resist in a situation of isolation and to resist on both sides. That is to resist to conditionality of imperialist aid to Yugoslavia using a dissident break within the communist movement. But Darko Suvin stresses that, that because of the independence of the system and because of the introduction of self-management and popular conditions of another kind of orientation, even the imperialist aid couldn't impose a kind of neocolonial dependency. He was using, so it was not pure things, but and it permit to resist both on both aspects. So the second aspect is that then the second axis of the book, the debates on what kind of society to build.
Catherine.
And I go a little bit quicker there. But it's important. So what power? What power? What state? What new society? So there was no Marxist consensus. And what is very interesting in Darko Suving's book also is quoting a lot of debates of that time. And Boris Kiedrich, who was an economist, a Marxist, who died unfortunately in 1943. But so who pushed forward radical proposals of workers' council, but which had to be combined with the, of course, the need of planning. How do you combine self-management rights? How do you combine a certain autonomy of enterprises with the need to redistribute the resources, especially in the country which is backward? and which needed industrialization. And the regime wanted industrialization for social justice and transformation of condition of life, and also to consolidate his working class bases, of course. So how do you combine all that? I don't go into the detail here, but that reopened the debate, which was going on and up to the 60s, for instance, in the Cuban debate where Ernest Mandel was involved with Che Guevara and Beta Lyman's on the debate on, well, what place for market, what place for a market stimulant or not, what place for planning, what kind of democracy, and so on. And Darko Suvin's books, and I try to do it in our book too, is going back to those main debate. I want to stress to finish, not to be too long then, on the present situation with the two main dimensions. I want to quote here first Darko Suvin. He says, was there any sense in the revolutionary horizons and therefore my youthful activism? I had no clue and said to myself, copying Brecht's Galileo, I have to understand it. That is, I have to understand the failure of the Yugoslav experience. My conclusion of this book, yes, there was a strong emancipatory sense in then, even if as halfway threatened and later betrayed. So that is not a pure. And he said that, of course, there's a problem to which Darko Suvin is resisting, and we are resisting in our book too. That is, in the present context, after the failure of all the revolutions of the 20th century, and for the Yugoslavia, the bloody dismantling of that experience, there is also an ideological and political dominant trend to try and control present thinking and the organization of political thinking also, in order to control the interpretation of past revolutions, reduced to gulag, reduced to the failures, and through this control, an Orwelliner, like who is controlling the present is controlling the past, who is controlling the past is controlling the future. Orwell wants to control. Orwell claims that the present dominant reactionary currents wants to control the present to control the interpretation of past revolution, and controlling the past revolution, they want to prevent new revolutions and new resistance. And Darko Suvin wanted to resist to this. So that's why he said in a dual dimension of his own lens, that is a critical approach of that experience, like in our book, of course, radical critical approach, based on emancipatory aims, that is the second aspect, that is having emancipatory lens in that critical approach, not leaving the critical approach to counter-revolutionary currents. And of course, I share, like Darko Suvin says, that there is the democratic issue, that is the radical democratic issue within the revolution, is the key feature, the key lesson, the key problem to be solved. So that's why we put in the book also the link between the self-management issue, the issue which is within current struggles today of commons, and the democratic question. Commons, the world commons, and I finish on that, this concept can be used in all sense. It can be completely appropriated even by Macron in France, you see, and by liberals, who present commons as, you see, a way to break even with the
with a welfare state and with any... it's do it yourself, but that is a way to accept that there is no solidarity and no defense of social rights and of public services. So comments can be used in a reactionary way. But the way it is presented in the book, linked with David Harvey, or also with the feminist approaches that we quoted in the book, is the idea for the commons is not linked to a thing, but to a process of human relationship, democratic human relationship. Who together want to deal with health issues, enterprises, or at different territorial level. So the big question is, at what level do you unite to try and manage together a kind of common? And it raises the question of political power, of decision making, and democratic power. In the dealing of common issues, common rights, and common goods. And so it's to be related with the debate which existed on self-management. That is, at what level do you permit centralized and decentralized choice? It is not because it is centralized that it is not democratic and that it is statist. But you need an articulation of democratic choices at all level, articulate. And this is very closely linked to the issue of commons. And so to finish, the idea also and my own central hypothesis and conviction is that today the colonial communism must integrate the fight against all oppressions, that is, intersectional oppressions, that is, gender workers, national, that is, also anti-racist dimensions of the fight, and again, a system which is more than ever globalized. And so that is that articulation of first thinking of how to unite, at what level in order to be efficient resisting to such a system, and who do you try to unite and how, and also how do you subordinate the rethinking of the society to explicit goals where use values, human relationships are dominant against the market domination, even if you use money, even if you use some market, but not financial market, not labor market, and socialized market of goods, like Jan Jelsen said in her contribution to the debate which exists in New Left Review here between Mandel and Nov. And that is the point that I wish to finish. Thank you.
Right, thank you. Well, it's for me a pleasure to take part in this panel with Katrin. I first met Katrin some 46 years ago. We were at the same kindergarten as well. Yeah. I can say that what I find very striking is this combination of continuity and change that Katrin very much represents, probably one of the persons in my kind of intellectual environment that who is probably the best illustration of continuity. This adherence to a set of principles and in an almost invariable manner. So there's a lot of loyalty there to our initial views, and at the same time the ability to bring in and combine this continuity with you know, a very open-minded approach to what may appear to others as new fashions or whatever. There, Catherine is always willing to take on board what comes, if, I mean, as long as she believes that this is not contradictory with the continuity itself, but enriching and updating and modernizing this continuity. And we can see this actually in the title of this book itself, and actually in the two terms that are in the phrase that is at the heart, at the core of this title, decolonial communism, where both terms refer to something that is relatively new in terms of conceptualization with regard to the Marxist continuity that Catherine has been upholding. And as she explained, and I'm sure she'll get back to these issues in the discussion, and I wish she does, but, well, decolonial, I mean, the way Catherine put decolonial would probably very much irritate a lot of those who use this term. That is, by trying to explain that St. Marx and Lenin and the Third International and all that, all these were in some way decolonial, okay? That would certainly be a non-starter with a lot of those who use this in post-colonial, decolonial studies and the rest. But at the same time, Catherine is not doing that, if you want, just to show that, well, there's nothing new in what you say. But accepting the view that indeed we have to rediscover this dimension in our heritage and use it again in conjunction with those who focus on this aspect of things. And the same goes for the term communism, although it's less obvious than decolonial, where decolonial is a neologism, which is not the case, of course, of communism. But it's good to remember that communism refers to the concept of in common and the commons. And this idea of the commons is a way of putting this whole problem, which is new, I mean, in some way, at least in some of the theories or the intellectual input that Catherine dealt with here. There is something which is not just a continuation of something. There is something really new in the way of putting the problem. And here, let me get to this aspect. I wish actually that Catherine, in the discussion, explains more about that, because the way she puts this idea of commons is as something transcending the classical dichotomy between state and market, public and private, okay? And, well, that's quite important and a very interesting idea, because we have been stuck for ages in this dichotomy and this kind of debate. And so the question would be, and I mean, that's to incite Catherine to come back on that, how does this notion of commons go beyond this dichotomy? And how does it differ from a phrase like market socialism, which you'll find in the book originates in the Yugoslav experience, although it has become mostly connected to China nowadays, with a huge difference, of course, between these cases. And we'll see through that. I mean, that's one aspect which is very important in what Catherine has been doing, and which is reflected in this book. This book is a kind of sum of many, many, many years of work and research and reflection. Is the fact that Catherine, early on from her doctoral thesis, I think, focused on on the Yugoslav experience, which is definitely not the main focus of practically everybody else, except a very few number of people, when discussing socialism and the experiences of the 20th century. I mean, we all agree, I guess, that one condition for the elaboration of a Marxism of the 21st century is to be, I mean, to use a phrase by Daniel Ben Saïd that Catherine refers to, the devoir d'inventaire, that is the fact of needing to revisit, if you want, the past experience and draw a balance sheet and see what you can keep and what you should discard. And in this very absolutely necessary work to be done in the production of a Marxism for the 20th century with regard to the what happened in the 20th century in the name of Marxism, the Yugoslav experience is one of the least studied, and at the same time, it's probably one of the most interesting, as you can see when you read the book and other writings like the book Catherine presented at the beginning. And we can see also that, I mean, this experience, although today it might seem as, you know, something completely marginal, but in its time, in the 60s, it had a real echo. I mean, the idea of self-management was very much propelled by the Yugoslav experience. And in the 60s, prior to 68, that was an important intellectual current in the production of a non-Stalinist Marxism. And, you have the Yugoslav experience. It quite obviously influenced the Algerian experience, where you had self-management in Algeria. That's a very, very post-colonial, decolonial, whatever you want to call it, country in that regard. So this dimension of the problem this dimension of the input is very important, and Catherine is definitely one of the persons who studied that with an eye, with a view to generalize, if you want, the lessons that you can draw from that, and that you will find in this book. And here again, this continuity and change is quite clear, because Catherine has been working for a very long time on Yugoslavia, and some of this past work is in the book, but you will find how Catherine is always willing to renew her view, renew herself, take on board new lights shed on issues that she has been studying for so long. Not to be long, just to carry on presenting the book from that angle, this is not only a book about Yugoslavia. You might get this impression from what has been said until now, but it's much broader than this in its scope. It's a general book on, a discussion of what, I mean, as the title puts it, decolonial communism, with the definition we gave of the second term, communism, and the whole issue of post-revolutionary society. That's a book about post-revolutionary society, and a book about the balance sheet of at least parts of the experiences of the 20th century in that regard. And you have sections on Cuba and the discussions in Cuba about market and planification and market incentives. You have a discussion of a variety of other experiences, some of them in Latin America, including from Chile to the more recent experiences in the last few decades, or Portugal, which is also a country where such themes came to the fore. And of course, the broader issue of Eastern Europe after the wall, is also discussed in the book, plus a number of let's say a combination, an intersectionality in approach, in approaching issues. So you have the feminist dimension along the decolonial, along the communist in the commons in the sense I mentioned, and that. So that's definitely, I would say, a very important contribution to this elaboration of Marxism for the 21st century, which is absolutely needed. And I very much recommend this book to anyone, and I guess there are many here, who is interested in that formulation, in that elaboration. It's a collective book. So the architect of the book is Catherine. A big, probably half of the book is Catherine's, or maybe something like this. But there are other contributors, and it's from that angle. There are some contributors who have been. I mean, this is a selection. It's not the typical kind of collective book where you would have some call for papers or something like that. And no, that's different here. That's someone who selected some old texts, some new texts, and all that, and combine them into giving this balance sheet on some dimensions of the problem that I referred to. So thank you again, and thank you, Catherine, for this major effort, and thanks for Resistance Books for the publication of this big volume. I mean, what I got is 500 pages and more. How many pages will it be in paper?
About 300 pages.
300, okay. Thank you very much.
You can get it.
Okay, we had the three speakers in an even and combined way had the discipline to keep it within the 1 hour time frame so the floor is open to anyone who wishes to make a question to the presenters, or a small intervention. There are many interesting topics that have been put forward. Yes?
I think that this summary, I've read some of your critiques of Cuba, and I'd like to hear what you say about Cuba now.
Okay, any other question? And please do introduce yourselves when asking a question or making a small intervention. Any other? Okay, well, Catherine, you can.
Okay. First, I want to say that on Cuba, I'm not a specialist of Cuba, and I would not write an article on that myself. I prefer to use what exists from two aspects. First, in the book, you have Samuel Farber article, who is a Cuban himself, who used to live in the U.S. after a period of living in Cuba. And he is making, and what is presented on Cuba is related also to the debate which is presented in the book in the 60s. That is the debate which occurred in Cuba between Ernest Mandel, Che Guevara, and Bettelheim, and Samuel Farber judgment on that debate also. I think you asked me about now the situation. I think it's I think Cuban is at a very dangerous road, crossroad for a transformation into some society which would adopt and integrate the domination of market regulation, but with resistance. So I think you have better to read recent articles written on that, which is not put in the book. This is not the case, but the issue which Cuban society and leftists are confronted to is precisely how to protect from the domination of market regulation. How do you both develop something from within which could be rooted in the population itself, that is, democratic procedures in the control of economy and of political choices. So that is precisely, for the moment, what is absolutely not clear. But there are lots of contributions which have been even produced in Jacobin recently, which are recommended to be read, which tend to prove, which is not the issue of the book, but which tend to prove that there are really left-oriented currents which do exist within Cuba. And so I think it's, that's not my topic to make a judgment now on that, but I think it's an internal issue, which is really related to the point of also planned market democracy within a society.
Any other question, intervention? And do introduce yourself.
Frank Seaman. I wanted to ask whether any particular resonances of the debates on worker self-management within the modern inheritor states from the old Yugoslavia within the left then, or is it just part of the general history of the whole left worldwide now, not something that, that resonates particularly for Croats or Serbs in the
today, you
left.
Mean?
Yeah.
Let's see if we have any other question or intervention?
Well, I put questions.
Yes, that's right.
They are part of the.
I also have at least. Well, I can make a small. Oh, please do.
Hi, I'm Kieran. Thank you for your talk. I was just wondering, in terms of the term decolonial, in what way the book engages with, the decolonial moment in theory, which seems to be mostly about metaphysics and epistemology. I was wondering, are you using the term in the same way as that, or is it doing something else with it?
Okay, any other question, intervention, so that we can gather up and give the floor to the speaker? Anyway, I'd like to make a small question and a small comment. Well, the comment is, I think it's what's important about this book, I've had some time to go through it a little bit, is that it brings back the... yes, I will speak louder. Okay, so I say that one of the interesting things of the book is that it brings back exactly a kind of debate that today we tend to forget. And I think that the Yugoslav experience, first, not only the importance of the Yugoslav experience, but also I think the way it tried to go beyond the simple plan versus the market dividing line. I think that this is something that now, and I'm not saying that not only through the experience of actually non-existing socialism, but also through the experience, so theoretical developments, for example, value form theory, we know that the relationship between relations of production and the market form is much deeper. You cannot simply change the relationship of ownership and then you have socialism. So, and I think that the very idea of self-management, with its focus on relations of production, changing what is happening inside the firm, inside the economic unit, in order to transcend the market by going from production towards circulation, not vice versa, which was in a certain way, the idea of the plan is interesting, it's fascinating, I think it's important to go back to. And also, where we understand that now we know that any kind of transition period would be much longer, in the sense that the historical produced natural character of the market comes through an entire period of transformation that leads to the dominance of the capitalist mode of production. So you, in order to go beyond the market, the actual dominance, but a similar kind of deep societal transformation of relations of production to arrive at a society that doesn't think in terms of the natural character of the market, thinks in different ways to actually allocate resources and services. So that's my comment. And my question is, one interesting part of the book is that you have included translations from praxis, which is really important. It's a quasi-forgotten moment of Marxist, of the history of post-World War II Marxism. So what the question is, if you could say anything more, what was the relationship between the praxis group, its elaborations, and self-management as a movement at that period? Any other? Okay,
so complicated, many questions. First, a factual aspect on today. There has been, we must be very clear. You must know perhaps that about the periodization. The end of the Yugoslav Federation and system was 1989-91. The decade, Tito and the historical leaders died in 1980. And that was at the very same period, that is during the 80s, the debt crisis. So it was a period of, the 80 was the a period of internal, both economic and political deep crisis under the pressure of International Monetary Fund and in internal transformation of a part of the party, like in other Eastern European countries, into a new bourgeoisie, coming out of a part of the parties and through the transformation of the federation into a confederation, yes, with increasing, in fact, that there was increasing nationalist conflicts, which reflected, in fact, the fact that there was no real Yugoslav bourgeoisie, but national bourgeoisies. Trying to transform the state and the ownership into state, their own state national control, in order afterwards to privatize it. So, and in the 90s, then you had the bloody transition, that is so-called inter-ethnic and so on, wars, which behind it was not fatal ethnic hatreds, but the attempt from the new emerging classes to, and especially in the dominant part, that is Croatia, Serbia, and Slovenia, to control the biggest part as possible of the territory. Well, okay, why do I say this? Because this that was already the first decade of hyperinflation and crisis, political corruption, and so on. Then, the decade of the 90s, which was the decade of bloody confrontations. And then afterwards, the integration in world capitalist system, which is not better, and which meant a complete destruction, discontinuity, and destruction of the former system and rights, both on citizenship, national rights, now defined on nationalist point of view, not free, decision of what you are with different kind of identity, but you must choose between being a Croat or a Serb and so on, and also, of course, the deep social destruction of the whole system and rights and so on. So this is three decades, and now there is a new generation. So it is in the there is a kind of link still exists, which is emerging between a new generation of young people being around les années 20 ans, 30 ans, 30 years old, and so, something like 20, 30, 40 years old, and the grandparents, when they still exist. And in between is terrible. Huh? But and there is an incredible wish, because the young generation, there is an incredible exodus. I have been involved in many meetings in the subversive festival in Zagreb, which existed several years. Where different forums, Balkan forums, were built to try to rebuild some links and rethinking of the past. In Slovenia, is this, the part Slovenia is very small part of the country that is which entered the European Union and the Eurozone also. 2 million inhabitants, and which was not so much destroyed, and which Slovenia was also the most developed part of the Yugoslav system, and the one which benefited the most of self-management and of the Titoist regime, in fact. And there was a very strong trade union in the Slovenian society, and when there was the break in 91 in Slovenia, Slovenia as an independent country was dominated by class and political struggles, very specific, as when you compare to all the other capitalist transformation in Yugoslavia and also Eastern Europe. So that is to say that in Slovenia and a little bit in Croatia, that there were the most resistance and even some combination of alliance and the rethinking of the past between trade unionists in Slovenia and the young generation, with a self-managed independent kind of university, Workers' Punk University in Slovenia, where came for several years, that is in the 2000s and so on, people from the whole Balkan countries, young people, and those young people were also going abroad in Austria and Germany and so on for studies and learning through internet, that is the internet generation, of all what Marxist living thinking has produced, and inviting people, I was among those, to discuss. And so there is now a kind of reappropriation of the past by this young generation, with in Slovenia real center, and with the emergence of a new party also, which is explicitly based on what were the social upsurge in 2014, and also the youth generation in those parallel university and so on, and putting forward the issue of rethinking socialism as a democratic project. So there is something left, and then existed in 2014 in Bosnia, for instance, an upsurge, social upsurge, of plenums based on the workers' resistance to privatization, but that was very soon defeated also. So the political conditions of resistance, very difficult. But for the first time have been published in Slovenian language this year. When at the presentation of my book, there was a television, and the main newspaper of Slovenia, 2-3 pages of account about this. Incredible. So, a big contradictory situation. I mean, isolation is impossible. So there is a terrible need of an international relationship to rebuild an alternative anti-capitalist thinking. It's not possible in one country. It was never possible in one country. And it's, well, So that's to give you some elements, very difficult. Then, transitional, but your comments and articulate also to some questions. It was a remark, but I want to stress that my way, like for Darko Suvin, to define the communism, into rethinking it, is to refuse any kind of separate stages. After the break, there is a need of a break with capitalism. But that opens a transitional society, which is defined, which was defined by the Bolsheviks, and which is to be defined as a conflicting society, still with classes, gender, national, social conflicts, confronted to the environment and so on, but which is understood as a transition. So, like Darko Suvin said, between capitalism and communism, if we keep communism, not with a very precise any kind of model of society, but as a concrete utopia, like Bloch would say, but a concrete utopia meaning, if we do, suppression of all relationship of oppression, all mixed relationship of oppression, and which means a radical democracy. So this is never, this is an horizon which is present in the ongoing struggles today, which is not for the future, it is for today. It is for today something which is also a way to transform the kind of organization where we are involved in order that those aims for the future are present in the way to fight against a relationship of oppression today. But it is the idea of a social, of a transitional period, as you say, it's very lasting. So Darko Suvin says the word socialism, when he uses it means that is a transitional society between capitalism and communism, not with precise model of what it should be according to each one according to and so on, no precise model of distribution and of production. But then, coming to the articulation between commons and communism and market socialism and so on, that is the I agree with you that the big problem of the traditional thinking on those had been an opposition of plan, market, centralization, decentralization, and so on. The real emphasis is put not on this, but is put on satisfaction of needs, including in the needs the relationship with environment and all human relationships, genders, dimension, racist, anti-racist, and social, and so on. Who decides what are the fundamental needs to be satisfied? The people themselves, in the given conditions. So there is no precondition, the development of productive forces to try and satisfy needs. No precondition. There are obviously a problem of resources, problem of context, and this is a process of decision-making to say what are now the priorities, taking into account the concrete situation. It's not to be put to tomorrow, it's today. So no precondition, only the question of the people wanting to satisfy what is legitimate in the 21st century. In the 21st century, having a roof, going to school, having an access to health services, and dignity. Dignity in human relationship are immediate goals for mass mobilization against all obstacles. And then the obstacles are to be dealt with through a concrete analysis of who are the enemy, who are those who resist to such legitimate goals. And then the question of what is to be centralized, what is to be decentralized. You see, if for instance, commons sometimes are put forward in a concrete goal of resistance within, against capitalist system, for instance, around a clinic, in clinic, comme on dit.
Clinic.
Okay, health center. But you see, do you want to satisfy the access to health only for the local limited person, or do you fight for right for all? At what level? At what territorial level? There is a concrete dimension from the national to the continental, for instance, European issue, or and so on. So, at what level do you want to have satisfaction of such and such rights for all? And when we say for all, it means not for only what are defined as the good French or the good British against the bad citizens, you see? So that's concretely raised the notion of right for all, and at what level do you fight for that? So it can begin at a local level, and it is very important to concretize the fight for an alternative society, even at a local level, even in a clinic, even in a municipality. But then you are confronted to the fact, and even a factory through cooperative, a kind of the protecting jobs through a transformation of a factory. But you are confronted to a market environment. So, the question of market socialism is a key issue, key problem. That is, you cannot have democratic control of choices if market is the regulator. That is the very point. If you think that market can indicate, because there was a debate among Marxists, that is, okay, we get rid of capitalist ownership, and then we can use market, okay? But even in Yugoslavia, for instance, current who were not at all pro-capitalist, current who were not at all to restore capitalist system, but wanted to improve productivity, wanted to improve efficiency in production, and thought that through market competition it will be a stimulant, either at the national level or even with a stimulant through international competition. And that is a disaster. That is a disaster because behind international prices, market prices, or even national prices, if it is through competition, there is no transparency. And so-called low-cost or efficient production can cover conditions of exploitation, and of destruction of environment, which are not acceptable, and so on and so forth. So there is a need, I refer to, and I stress the interest to reread what Jan Jelsen produced in New Left Review in the years of the debate, Mandelnov in New Left Review. She was speaking of socialization of the market. What did that mean? She said that behind the prices, first of all, it meant that behind the notion of market, you get rid of what the capitalist system introduced. Market existed before capitalism. But what did capitalism is to generalize market to nature, to money, and to human being, like Polanyi said. Okay? So you have now to be concrete. We refuse the transformation of human being into a commodity. We refuse the transformation of nature into a commodity. But then we don't refuse the possibility of use of money and of a certain market of goods to help decentralized choices. But we don't accept any kind of choice given by the market. Let us say that if you can use market prices and relations in certain goods, but it is not because the market indicates that there is a need here not enough production, or that it is not good to produce it, that you accept this line. You have always to subordinate the indication that the market gives to you to direct judgment. That is concrete analysis, and that Diane Nelson said you must have observatories, social association also of different kind and so on, to put transparency behind prices. What are the relationship of the social relationship of production? What are the environmental conditions? But also, what are the needs which are not satisfied and which cannot be expressed through prices? And this is the key issue, that is to... what should be decentralized, what should be centralized? Of course, we have also to take into account that today we can have a combination of decentralization and centralization through internet, through the possibility of using programs which permits to combine decentralized choices with macroeconomic global evaluation of what are the resources, and but behind even the technical aspect, a democratic procedure of deciding what are the needs that you want to be satisfied for all. And second, with what financial means. If you want the needs to be satisfied for all, then you need public instruments to finance them. In order that you have different municipalities with unequal conditions and so on, different branches and so on, you don't leave the process of financing to a decentralized process. I finish with only one remark from Praxis. And that is a very important question you raised, because what was the problem in Yugoslavia in the different phase of the reform? The question, what is the ownership? What does it mean, public ownership? What does it mean, social ownership? So the first refusal was to identify public ownership or social ownership to state ownership. That is the refusal of a Soviet kind of control on the production and the net surplus. Bon. But then there was the market socialism. And that was in Yugoslavia in the 60s, that is 65-71, there was a suppression of all kind of planning, with the suppression of all investment funds. Before there was a kind of more flexible planning for strategical issues, not detailed one, which permitted self-management at the level of the factory, but those strategical choices were still party-state kind of decision. So the second period, market socialism, was not at all, or not mainly, even if some element existed on that point, a pro-capitalist trend. It was a pressure of rich republic that you have in all societies in Europe, or inside a country, inside Italy and so on. The rich republic who want to keep their own product for themselves, independent, against planning. Secondly, pressure from self-communists, the workers in self-management factories. In the 50s, they have only the control of 30% of their production. The rest went to the central funds. So the destruction of the central fund was assimilated to give back to the workers the whole control of what they produce. But in fact, it was very rapidly combined with development of a banking system and the transformation of a kind of pro-capitalist trends, which accumulate more and more of that product. So what was the social ownership? And the Praxis people, it was also said by Cardel and Tito in the Self-Management Congress in 71, were analyzing the process of self-management being completely stifled by the market. And so social ownership was to be neither state ownership nor a group ownership, factory by factory, or belonging to a private part of the population or financial system and so on. So it was to be to everyone and to no one. But what did it mean? That meant, first, and that was praxis, also emphasis, yes, that is not only the producers should not be atomized factory by factory, but they had to be linked together through the planning system, through investment front control. Then there were community of what was called community of interest around, for instance, the managing of a service and so on, with producers and consumers and citizens together managing. So that is the social ownership was to be built through self-management planning, through specific assemblies within the state, that is socialization of the state, socialization of planning, socialization of the market. So I stop here.